Welcome to Coco Club.
Coco Club is a radio program put on by the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. Tune in to WHDD 91.9 each week and join me, Mrs. Sam, for a short story, a poem, some cocoa, and a sweet dessert. This is a weekly series. The recipe for each dessert will be posted the week previous, so we can all try our hand in baking something new and enjoy it as a family while we listen to a story. I will ask questions at the end of Coco Club to help every listener engage with each other about the story's meaning and what they liked about it. Please join us on social media to post photos of how your recipe turned out, or tell us what you thought about the story at facebook.com/Hotchkiss Library. This week, we made sugar cookies and are finishing the third part of The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. Roald Dahl was a British novelist, short story writer, poet, screenwriter, and wartime fighter pilot. "Well, well, well," said Henry Sugar. "Now that is extremely interesting." He closed the exercise book and sat gazing at the rain splashing against the windows of the library. "This," Henry Sugar went on, talking aloud to himself, "is a terrific piece of information. It could change my life." The piece of information Henry was referring to was that Imrat Khan had trained himself to read the value of a playing card from the reverse side. And Henry the gambler, the rather dishonest gambler, had realized at once that if only he could train himself to do the same thing, he could make a fortune. For a few moments, Henry allowed his mind to dwell upon the marvelous things he would be able to do if he could read cards from the back. He would win every single time at canasta and bridge and poker, and better still, he would be able to go to any casino in the world and clean up at blackjack and all the other high-powered card games they played. In gambling casinos, as Henry knew very well, nearly everything depended, in the end, upon the turn of a single card, and if you knew beforehand what the value of that card was, then you were home and dry. But could he do it? Could he actually train himself to do this thing? He didn't see why not. That stuff with the candle flame didn't appear to be particularly hard work, and according to the book, that was really all there was to it, just staring into the middle of the flame and trying to concentrate upon the face of the person you loved best. It would probably take him several years to bring it off, but then who in the world wouldn't be willing to train for a few years in order to beat the casinos every time he went in? "By golly," he said aloud, "I'll do it. I'm going to do it." He sat very still in the armchair in the library, working out a plan of campaign. Above all, he would tell nobody what he was up to. He would steal the little book from the library, so that none of his friends might come upon it by chance and learn the secret. He would carry the book with him wherever he went. It would be his Bible. He couldn't possibly go out and find a real live yogi to instruct him, so the book would be his yogi instead. It would be his teacher. Henry stood up and slipped the slim blue exercise book under his jacket. He went out of the library and straight upstairs to the bedroom they had given him for the weekend. He got out his suitcase and hid the book underneath his clothes. Then he went downstairs again and found his way to the butler's pantry. "John," he said, addressing the butler, "can you find me a candle, just an ordinary white candle?" Butlers were trained never to ask for reasons. They simply obeyed orders.
"Do you wish for a candle holder as well, sir?"
"Yes, a candle and a candle holder."
"Very good, sir. Shall I bring them to your room?"
"No, I'll hang around here till you find them." The butler soon found a candle and candle holder. Henry said, "And now could you find me a ruler?" The butler found him a ruler. Henry thanked him and returned to his bedroom. When he was inside the bedroom, he locked the door. He drew all the curtains so the place was in twilight. He put the candle holder with the candle in it on the dressing table and pulled up a chair. When he sat down, he noticed with satisfaction that his eyes were exactly level with the wick of the candle. Now, using the ruler, he positioned his face 16 inches from the candle, which again was what the book had said must be done. That Indian fellow had visualized the face of the person he loved best, which in his case was a brother. Henry didn't have a brother. He decided to visualize his own face. With his cigarette lighter, he lit the wick. A yellow flame appeared and burned steadily. Henry sat quite still and stared into the candle flame. The book had been quite right. The flame, when you looked at it closely, did have three separate parts. There was the yellow outside. Then there was the mauve inner sheath. And right in the middle was the tiny magic area of absolute blackness. He stared at the tiny black area. He focused his eyes upon it and kept staring at it. And as he did so, an extraordinary thing happened. His mind went absolutely blank, and his brain ceased fidgeting around, and all at once it felt as though he himself, his whole body, was actually encased within the flame, sitting snug and cozy within the little black area of nothingness. With no trouble at all, Henry allowed the image of his own face to swim into sight before him. He concentrated upon the face, and nothing but the face. He blocked out all other thoughts. He succeeded completely in doing this, but only for about 15 seconds. After that, his mind began to wander, and he found himself thinking about gambling casinos and how much money he was going to win. At this point, he looked away from the candle and gave himself a rest. This was his very first effort. He was thrilled. He had done it. Admittedly, he hadn't kept it up for very long, but neither had that Indian fellow on the first attempt. After a few minutes, he tried again. It went well. He had no stopwatch to time himself with, but he sensed that this was definitely a longer go than the first one. "It's terrific," he cried. "I'm going to succeed. I'm going to do it." He had never been so excited by anything in his life. From that day on, no matter where he was or what he was doing, Henry made a point of practicing with the candle every morning and every evening. Often he practiced at midday as well. For the first time in his life, he was throwing himself into something with genuine enthusiasm, and the progress he made was remarkable. After 6 months, he could concentrate absolutely upon his own face for no less than 3 minutes without a single outside thought entering his mind. The yogi of Hardwar had told the Indian fellow that a man would have to practice for 15 years to get that sort of result. But wait, the yogi had said something else. He had said, and here Henry eagerly consulted the little blue exercise book for the 100th time, he had said that on extremely rare occasions, a special person comes along who is able to develop this power in only 1 or 2 years. "That's me," Henry cried. "It must be me. I am the 1 in a million person who is gifted with the ability to acquire yoga powers at an incredible speed. Whoopee and hooray! It won't be long now before I'm breaking the bank in every casino in Europe and America." But Henry, at this point, showed unusual patience and good sense. He didn't rush to get out a pack of cards to see if he could read them from the reverse side. In fact, he kept well away from card games of all kinds. He had given up bridge and canasta and poker as soon as he had started working with the candle. What's more, he had given up razzing around to parties and weekends with his rich friends. He had become dedicated to this single aim of acquiring yoga powers, and everything else would have to wait until he had succeeded. Sometime during the 10th month, Henry became aware, just as Imrat Khan had done before him, of a slight ability to see an object with his eyes closed. When he closed his eyes and stared at something hard with fierce concentration, he could actually see the outline of the object he was looking at. "It's coming to me," he cried. "I'm doing it. It's fantastic." Now he worked harder than ever at his exercises with the candle, and at the end of the first year, he could actually concentrate upon the image of his own face for no less than 5.5 minutes. At this point, he decided the time had come to test himself with the cards. He was in the living room of his London flat when he made this decision, and it was near midnight. He got out a pack of cards and a pencil and paper. He was shaking with excitement. He placed the pack upside down before him and concentrated on the top card. All he could see at first was the design on the back of the card. It was a very ordinary design of thin red lines, one of the commonest playing card designs in the world. He now shifted his concentration from the pattern itself to the other side of the card. He concentrated with great intensity upon the invisible underneath of the card, and he allowed no other single thought to creep into his mind. 30 seconds went by, then 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Henry didn't move. His concentration was intense and absolute. He was visualizing the reverse side of the playing card. No other thought of any kind was allowed to enter his head. During the 4th minute, something began to happen. Slowly, magically, but very clearly, the black symbols became spades. Alongside the spades appeared the figure 5, the 5 of spades. Henry switched off his concentration, and now, with shaking fingers, he picked up the card and turned it over. It was the 5 of spades. "I've done it," he cried aloud, leaping up from his chair. "I've seen through it. I'm on my way." After resting for a while, he tried again, and this time he used a stopwatch to see how long it took him. After 3 minutes and 58 seconds, he read the card as the King of Diamonds. He was right. The next time he was right again, and it took him 3 minutes and 54 seconds. That was 4 seconds less. He was sweating with excitement and exhaustion. "That's enough for today," he told himself. He got up and poured himself an enormous drink of whiskey and sat down to rest and to gloat over his success. His job now, he told himself, was to keep practicing and practicing with the cards until he could see through them instantly. He was convinced it could be done. Already on the second try, he had knocked four seconds off his time. He would give up working with the candle and concentrate solely upon the cards. He would keep at it day and night. And that is what he did. But now that he could smell real success at the offing, he became more fanatical than ever. He never left his flat except to buy food and drink. All day and often far into the night, he crouched over the cards with the stopwatch beside him, trying to reduce the time it took him to read from the reverse side. Within a month, he was down to 1.5 minutes. At the end of 6 months of fierce, concentrated work, he could do it in 20 seconds. But even that was too long. When you are gambling in a casino and the dealer is waiting for you to say yes or no to the next card, you're not going to be allowed to stare at it for 20 seconds before making up your mind. 3 or 4 seconds would be permissible, but no more. Henry kept at it. From now on, it became more and more difficult to improve his speed. To get down from 20 seconds to 19, it took him a week of very hard work. From 19 to 18 took him nearly 2 weeks. And 7 more months went by before he could read through a card in 10 seconds flat. His target was 4 seconds. He knew that unless he could see through a card in a maximum of 4 seconds, he wouldn't be able to work the casino successfully. Yet the nearer he got toward the target, the more difficult it became to reach it. It took 4 weeks to get his time down from 10 seconds to 9, and 5 more weeks to go from 9 to 8, but at this stage hard work no longer bothered him. His powers of concentration had now developed to such a degree that he was able to work for 12 hours at a stretch with no trouble at all. And he knew with absolute certainty that he would get there in the end. He would not stop until he did. Day after day, night after night, he sat crouching over the cards with his stopwatch beside him, fighting with a terrible intensity to knock off those last few stubborn seconds of his time. The last 3 seconds were the worst of all. To get from 7 seconds down to his target of 4 took him exactly 11 months. The great moment came on a Saturday evening. A card lay face down on the table in front of him. He clicked the stopwatch and began to concentrate. At once he saw a blob of red. The blob swiftly took shape and became a diamond. And then, almost instantaneously, a figure 6 appeared in the top left-hand corner. He clicked the watch again. He checked the time. It was 4 seconds. He turned the card over. It was the 6 of diamonds. He had done it. He had done it in 4 seconds flat. He tried again with another card. In 4 seconds, he read it as the Queen of Spades. He went right through the pack, timing himself with every card. 4 seconds, 4 seconds, 4 seconds. It was always the same. He had done it at last. It was all over. He was ready to go. And how long had it taken him? It had taken him exactly 3 years and 3 months of concentrated work. And now for the casinos. When should he start? Why not tonight? Tonight was Saturday. All the casinos were crowded on Saturday nights. So much the better. There'd be less chance of becoming conspicuous. He went into his bedroom to change into his dinner jacket and black tie. Saturday was a dressy night at the big London casinos. He would go, he decided, to Lord's house. There are well over 100 legitimate casinos in London, but none of them is open to the general public. You must become a member if you are allowed to walk in. Henry was a member of no less than 10 casinos. Lord's house was his favorite. It was the finest and most exclusive in the country. Lord's house was a magnificent Georgian mansion in the center of London, and for over 200 years it had been the private residence of a duke. Now it was taken over by the bookmakers, and superb high-ceilinged rooms where the aristocracy and often royalty used to gather and play a gentle game of whilst were today filled with a new kind of people who played a very different sort of game. Henry drove to Lord's house and pulled up outside the great entrance. He got out of the car, but left the engine running. Immediately, an attendant in a green uniform came forward to park it for him. Along the curb on both sides of the street stood perhaps a dozen Rolls Royces. Only the very wealthy belonged to the Lord's house. "Why, hello, Mr. Sugar," said the man behind the desk, whose job it was to never forget a face. "We haven't seen you for years." "I've been busy," Henry answered. He went upstairs, up the marvelous wide staircase with its carved mahogany banisters, and entered the cashier's office. There he wrote a check for £1,000. The cashier gave him 10 large pink rectangular plaques made of plastic. On each it said 100. Henry slipped them into his pocket and spent a few minutes sauntering through the various gaming rooms to get the feel of things again after such a long absence. There is a big crowd here tonight. Well-fed women stood around the roulette wheel like plump hens around a feeding hopper. Jewels and gold were dripping over their bosoms and from their wrists. Many of them had blue hair. The men were in dinner jackets, and there wasn't a tall one among them. Why, Henry wondered, did this particular kind of rich man always have short legs? Their legs all seemed to stop at the knees, with no thighs above. Most of them had bellies coming out a long way, and crimson faces and cigars between their lips. Their eyes glittered with greed. All this Henry noticed. It was the first time in his life that he had looked with distaste upon this type of wealthy, gambling casino person. Up until now, he had always regarded them as companions, as members of the same group and class as himself. Tonight they seemed vulgar. Could it be, he wondered, that the yoga powers he had acquired over the last 3 years had altered him just a little bit? He stood watching the roulette. Upon the long green tables, people were placing their money, trying to guess which little slot the small white ball would fall into on the next spin of the wheel. Henry looked at the wheel, and suddenly, perhaps more from habit than anything else, he found himself beginning to concentrate upon it. It was not difficult. He had been practicing the art of total concentration for so long that it had become something of a routine. In a fraction of a second, his mind became completely and absolutely concentrated upon the wheel. Everything else in the room, the noise, the people, the lights, the smell of cigar smoke, all this was wiped out of his mind, and he saw only the round, polished roulette wheel with the small white numbers around the rim. The numbers went from 1 to 36, with a zero between 1 and 36. Very quickly, all the numbers blurred and disappeared in front of his eyes. All except one. All except the number 18. The 18 was the only number he could see. At first it was slightly fuzzy and out of focus. Then the edges sharpened, and the whiteness of it grew brighter, more brilliant, until it began to glow as though there was some bright light behind it. It grew bigger. It seemed to jump toward him. At that point, Henry switched off his concentration. The room swam back into his vision. "Have you all finished?" the croupier was saying. Henry took a $100 plaque from his pocket and placed it on the square marked 18 on the green table. Although the table was covered all over with other people's bets, his was the only one on 18. The croupier spun the wheel. The little white ball bounced and skittered around the rim. The people watched. All eyes were on the little ball. The wheel slowed. It came to rest. The ball jiggled a few more times, hesitated, then dropped neatly into slot 18. 18, called the croupier. The crowd sighed. The croupier's assistant scooped up the piles of losing plaques with a long-handed wooden scooper. But he didn't take Henry's. They paid him 36 to 1, 3,600 for his 100. They gave it to him in 3 1,000 plaques and 6 100s. Henry began to feel an extraordinary sense of power. He felt he could break this place if he wanted to. He could ruin this fancy, high-powered, expensive joint in a matter of hours. He could take a million off them, and all the stony-faced, sleek gentlemen who stood around watching the money rolling in would be scurrying about like panicky rats. Should he do that? It was a great temptation. But it would be the end of everything. He would become famous, and would never be allowed into a casino again anywhere in the world. He mustn't do it. He must be very careful not to draw attention to himself. Henry moved casually out of the roulette room and passed into a room where they were playing blackjack. He stood in the doorway watching the action. There were 4 tables. They were oddly shaped, these blackjack tables, each one curved like a crescent moon, with the players sitting on high stools around the outside of the half circle and the dealer standing on the inside. The packs of cards, at Lord's house they used 4 packs shuffled together, lay in an open-ended box known as a shoe, and the dealer pulled the cards out of the shoe one by one with his fingers. The reverse side of the first card in the shoe was always visible, but no others. Blackjack, as the casinos call it, is a very simple game. You and I know it by one of 3 other names, Pontoon 21 or Vingt Un. The player tries to get his cards to add up to as near as 21 as possible, but if he goes over 21, he's bust and the dealer takes the money. In nearly every hand, the player is faced with the problem of whether to draw another card and risk being bust, or whether to stick with what he's got. But Henry would not have that problem. In 4 seconds, he would have seen through the card the dealer was offering him, and he would know whether to say yes or no. Henry could turn blackjack into a farce. In all casinos, they have an awkward rule about blackjack betting that we do not have at home. At home, we look at our first card before we make the bet, and if it's a good one, we bet high. The casinos don't allow you to do this. They insist that everyone at the table makes his bet before the first card of the hand is dealt. What's more, you are not allowed to increase your bet later on by buying a card. None of this would disturb Henry either. So long as he sat on the dealer's immediate left, then he would always receive the first card in the shoe at the beginning of each deal. The reverse side of his card would be clearly visible to him, and he would read through it before he made his bet. Now, standing quietly just inside the doorway, Henry waited for a place to become vacant on the dealer's left at any of the 4 tables. He had to wait 20 minutes for this to happen, but he got what he wanted in the end. He perched himself on the high stool and handed the dealer one of the 1,000 plaques he had won at roulette. "All in 25s, please," he said. The dealer was a youngish man with black eyes and gray skin. He never smiled and spoke only when necessary. His hands were exceptionally slim, and there was an arithmetic in his fingers. He took Henry's plaque and dropped it into a slot in the table. Rows of different colored circular chips lay neatly in a wooden tray in front of him, chips for 25, 10, and 5, maybe 100 of each. With his thumb and forefinger, the dealer picked up a wedge of 25 chips and placed them in a tall pile on the table. He didn't have to count them. He knew there were exactly 20 chips in that pile. Those nimble fingers could pick up with absolute accuracy any number of chips from 1 to 20 and never be wrong. The dealer picked up a second lot of 20 chips, making it 40 in all. He slid them over the table to Henry. Henry stacked the chips in front of him, and as he did so, He glanced at the top card in the shoe. He switched on his concentration, and in 4 seconds he read it as a 10. He pushed out 8 of his chips, 200. This was the maximum stake allowed for blackjack at the Lord's house. He was dealt the 10, and for his second card he got a 9, 19 altogether. Everyone sticks on a 19. You sit tight and hope the dealer won't get 20 or 21. So when the dealer came around again to Henry, he said, 19, and passed on to the next player. Wait, Henry said. The dealer paused and came back to Henry. He raised his brows and looked at him with those cool black eyes. You wish to draw to 19? He asked, somewhat sarcastically. He spoke with an Italian accent, and there was scorn as well as sarcasm in his voice. There were only 2 cards in the pack that would not bust a 19, the ace, counting as a 1, and the 2. Only an idiot would risk drawing to 19, especially with 200 on the table. The next card to be dealt lay clearly visible in front of the shoe. At least the reverse side of it was clearly visible. The dealer had not yet touched it. Yes, Henry said. I think I'll have another card. The dealer shrugged and flipped the card out of the shoe. The 2 of clubs landed neatly in front of Henry, alongside the 10 and the 9. Thank you, Henry said. That will do nicely. 21, the dealer said. His black eyes glanced up again into Henry's face, and they rested there, silent, watchful, puzzled. Henry had unbalanced him. He had never in his life seen anyone draw to a 19. This fellow had drawn to a 19 with a calmness and a certainty that was quite staggering. And he had won. Henry caught the look in the dealer's eyes and realized at once that he had made a silly mistake. He had been too clever. He had drawn attention to himself. He must never do that again. He must be very careful in the future to how he used his powers. He must even make himself lose occasionally, and every now and again he must do something a bit stupid. The game went on. Henry's advantage was so enormous, he had difficulty keeping his winnings down to a reasonable sum. Every now and again he would ask for a third card, when he already knew it was going to bust him. And once, when he saw that his first card was going to be an ace, he put out his smallest stake and made a great show of cursing himself aloud for not having made a bigger bet in the first place. In an hour, he had won exactly £3,000, and there he stopped. He pocketed his chips and made his way back to the cashier's office to turn them in for real money. He had made $3,000 from blackjack and $3,600 from roulette, $6,600 in all. It could just have easily been $660,000. As a matter of fact, he told himself, he was now almost certainly able to make money faster than any man in the entire world. The cashier received Henry's piles of chips and plaques without twitching a muscle. He wore steel spectacles, and the pale eyes behind those spectacles were not interested in Henry. They looked only at the chips on the counter. This man also had arithmetic in his fingers. But he had more than that. He had arithmetic, trigonometry, and calculus, and algebra, and Euclidean geometry in every nerve of his body. He was a human calculating machine with 100,000 electric wires in his brain. It took him 5 seconds to count Henry's 120 chips. "Would you like a check for this, Mr. Sugar?" he asked. The cashier, like the man at the desk downstairs, knew every member by name. "No, thank you," Henry said. "I'll take it in cash." "As you wish," said the voice behind the spectacles, and he turned away and went to a safe at the back of the office that must have contained millions. By Lord's House standards, Henry's win was fairly small potatoes. The Arab oil boys were in London now, and they liked to gamble. So did the shady diplomats from the Far East, and the Japanese businessmen, and the British tax-dodging real estate operators. Staggering sums of money were being won and lost, mostly lost, in the large London casinos every day. The cashier returned with Henry's money and dropped the bundle of notes on the counter. Although there was enough to buy a small house or a large automobile, the chief cashier at Lord's House was not impressed. He might just as well have been passing Henry a pack of chewing gum for all the notice he took of the money he was dishing out. "You wait, my friend," Henry thought to himself as he pocketed the money. "You just wait." He walked away. Your car, sir? Said the man at the door in the green uniform. Not yet, Henry told him. I think I'll take a bit of fresh air first. He strolled away down the street. It was nearly midnight. The evening was cool and pleasant. The great city was still wide awake. Henry could feel the bulge in the inside pocket of his jacket, where the big wad of money was lying. He touched the bulge with one hand. He patted it gently. It was a lot of money for an hour's work. And what of the future? What was the next move going to be? He could make $1 million a month. He could make more if he wanted to. There was no limit to what he could make. Walking through the streets of London in the cool of the evening, Henry began to think about the next move. Now, had this been a made-up story instead of a true one, it would have been necessary to invent some sort of surprising and exciting end for it. It would not be difficult to do that, something dramatic and unusual. So before telling you what really did happen to Henry in real life, let us pause here for a moment to see what a competent fiction writer would have done to wrap up this story. His notes would read something like this. 1. Henry must die. Like Imrat Khan before him, he had violated the code of the yogi and used his powers for personal gain. 2. It would be best if he dies in some unusual and interesting manner that will surprise the reader. 3. For example, he could go home to his flat and start counting money, his money and gloating over it. While doing this, he might suddenly begin to feel unwell. He has a pain in his chest. 4. He becomes frightened. He decides to go to bed immediately and rest. He takes off his clothes. He walks naked to the closet to get his pajamas. He passes the full-length mirror that stands against the wall. He stops. He stares at the reflection of his naked self in the mirror. Automatically, from force of habit, he begins to concentrate. And then... 5. All at once he is seeing through his own skin. He sees through it in the same way that he saw through those playing cards a while back. It is like an X-ray picture, only far better. An X-ray can see only the bones and the very dense areas. Henry can see everything. He sees his arteries and veins with the blood pumping through him. He can see his liver, his kidneys, his intestines, and he can see his heart beating. He looks at the place in his chest where the pain is coming from, and he sees... or thinks he sees, a small dark lump inside the big vein, leading into the heart on the right-hand side. What could a small dark lump be doing inside the vein? It must be a blockage of some kind. It must be a clot, a blood clot. At first, the clot seems stationary. Then it moves. The movement is very slight, no more than 1 millimeter or 2. The blood inside the vein is pumping up behind the clot and pushing past it, and the little clot moves again. It jerks forward about 1/2 inch. This time up the vein toward the heart. Henry watches in terror. He knows, as almost everyone else in the world knows, that a blood clot that is broken free and is traveling in a vein will ultimately reach the heart. When it reaches the heart, you often die. That wouldn't be such a bad ending for a work of fiction, but this story is not fiction. It is true. The only untrue things about it are Henry's name and the name of the gambling casino. Henry's name was not Henry Sugar. His name has to be protected. It still must be protected. And for obvious reasons, one cannot call the casino by its real name. Apart from that, it is a true story. And because it is a true story, it must have a true ending. The true one may not be quite so dramatic or spooky as the made-up one could be, but it is nonetheless interesting. So here is what actually happened. So, we're going to actually end up finishing next week the final part of the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, because we are out of time for today. Thank you for joining me this week for Cocoa Club. Cocoa Club is hosted by the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. The sounds you heard in this recording are from freesound.org. I'm Mrs. Sam, and I hope you tune in again next week.